So far, we've concluded from episodes 3 and 4 that the eyewitness testimony weighs in favor of Oswald not being in place on the 6th floor at the time the shots were fired. Then, in episode 5, we talked about the presence of Oswald's fingerprints on 2 boxes near the sniper's nest, which is potentially not that incriminating since he worked on the 6th floor and handled the boxes. But Oswald's prints were also found on a long paper sack in the sniper's nest, which means that either Oswald awkwardly brought the gun in the building, holding it with his left index finger and right palm, then got it up to the 6th floor without being seen by anyone or putting any other prints on it, or the evidence was manufactured, which is a bold claim to make without proof. We also learned that aside from Buell Wesley Frazier, no one else saw Oswald bring the paper sack into the Texas School Book Depository, including Jack Doherty, who saw Oswald enter the building. But then again, the length of the paper sack Frazier and his sister described seeing Oswald with is materially shorter than the one found in the building, which means the only people who saw Oswald with a paper sack appear to be describing a different one, or they're both mistaken. And Frazier insisted that Oswald was carrying this paper sack under his armpit when he walked. There's no way he could do that with a 38-inch bag like the one in evidence. You can try it for yourself at home with a yardstick if you have one. This case is kind of an inconclusive mess so far. We're at a point where Oswald's guilt could go either way based on what we've looked at. Today, on Solving JFK, we'll continue to examine the evidence by taking a look at the 2 competing stories in the record of Oswald's getaway. One on a public bus, and the other in a Nash Rambler.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. The Warren Report says Oswald left the school book depository 3 minutes after the shooting at 12:33. He then boarded a bus 7 blocks away at the corner of Elm and Murphy. That bus was headed back towards the depository on its way to Oak Cliff. The bus driver, Cecil McWaters, identified Oswald at a police lineup as being the man who boarded his bus and then got off the bus at the intersection of Poydras and Lamar. Oswald's bus ride is not a disputed fact. Oswald himself told Captain Fritz that he rode the bus until it was stopped in traffic, which made him switch to a taxi. When he was arrested, Oswald was found with a bus transfer in his shirt pocket that was dated November 22, 1963, and marked with a unique punch mark from McWaters' bus. Also, Mary Bledsoe, Oswald's former landlord, happened to be on that bus and identified Oswald. She said that he boarded the bus looking like a maniac, wearing a brown shirt with all the buttons torn off and a hole in the sleeve at the right elbow. To even further hammer home the point that Oswald was on the bus, we have photographs of the bus that Oswald was on while he was on it. This brings us to a quick sidebar on photographer Stuart Reed. In addition to taking the only known photos of the bus Oswald was on, Reed was positioned across the street from the Texas Theater at the moment Oswald was escorted out the front door to snap a photo that has now become iconic. This has led skeptics to wonder whether Stuart Reed had foreknowledge of the assassination plot, specifically that Oswald would be on a bus and that Oswald would be arrested at the Texas Theater. It turns out that Reed was working in the Panama Canal Zone for the Army's Personnel Management Division at the time. He was in Dallas visiting his daughter on the day of the assassination, according to FBI reports about the photos. Reed himself was never questioned by the FBI, the Warren Commission, or any other investigative body. And that's all I could find on Stuart Reed. The bus photos are one thing. You can argue that he just took some pictures and he happened to capture Oswald's bus. But for Reed to get the bus photos and be positioned in front of the Texas Theater at the exact moment when Oswald was let out in handcuffs is a strange coincidence for sure. Okay, back to Oswald's escape. After Oswald gets off the bus, he walks to the Greyhound bus terminal and catches a cab driven by William Whaley. Oswald asks Whaley to take him to the 700 block of North Beckley, where his rooming house was located. The Warren Report says it would have taken 6 minutes to drive from the Greyhound station to 700 North Beckley, putting Oswald at his rooming house at 1 p.m. Whaley, the cab driver, says it actually took him 9 minutes and Oswald arrived at 1:03. These 3 minutes will become very important when we look at whether Oswald killed Officer J.D. Tippit. From Oswald's interrogation notes, corroborated by the bus pass and his former landlord's testimony, we know that he got on that bus. We also know from Whaley that Oswald then got a cab ride to his rooming house. So Oswald got on a bus, then got out and took a cab back to his rooming house. The Warren Report was correct about this. It's settled then. Or is it? The problem with knowing for sure that Oswald took the bus and then a cab to get to his rooming house is that it leaves open questions about what other witnesses around Dealey Plaza saw that day, namely, Oswald fleeing Dealey Plaza in a Nash Rambler station wagon. We mentioned Carolyn Walther last episode. She's the witness who saw a man with a rifle in a window on the fourth or fifth floor of the building, and a man behind the shooter in a brown sport coat. James Worrell, who was standing 4 feet away from the building, says he saw a man in a dark sports coat running out of the back of the depository shortly after the shooting. A third witness, Richard Randolph Carr, corroborates the idea of a man in a sport coat being on the sixth floor at the time of the shooting. Carr was in the courthouse walking up the stairwell. He was going to inquire about construction work with the foreman whose office was on the ninth floor. Carr stopped for a rest while walking up the stairwell and looked across the street at the depository. He noticed a man on the sixth floor of that building looking out the second window from the southeast corner. He was a, quote, heavy-set individual who was wearing a hat, a tan sport coat, and horn-rimmed glasses. Carr then heard what he thought was a car backfire, and then two more reports in quick succession. Then he went down the stairs to see what happened. When Carr got outside to Houston Street, he saw the same man in the tan sport coat who had been in the sixth floor window. Carr watched the man walk a block east and get into a 1961 or 62 Rambler station wagon parked right behind the depository on Record Street. Carr says the driver was a young black man. The Carr story gets even more interesting as you follow his life in the years after the assassination. According to Carr, an FBI agent pressured him to change his story and told him that if you didn't see Lee Harvey Oswald on the sixth floor with a rifle, you didn't see it. Later, the Dallas Police Department raided his house in the middle of the night, claiming that they were looking for stolen goods. Carr says he received threatening phone calls telling him to leave Texas, and when he listened to that warning and moved to Montana, he later found dynamite taped to his car ignition in Montana. Just before Carr testified in the Jim Garrison-led New Orleans trial related to the assassination, a gunman attempted to kill him. In a third attempt on Carr's life, he was stabbed but managed to kill one of the two men who attacked him in Atlanta. Richard Randolph Carr's story sounds fantastical, especially the part about all the attempts on his life after the fact. Carr was not the only person who saw the Green Rambler near Dealey Plaza that day. When Marvin Robinson was driving through Dealey Plaza immediately after the assassination, he had to slam on the brakes of his Cadillac to avoid hitting the light-colored Rambler just ahead of him. It had suddenly pulled over beside the curb. Robinson said that the Rambler picked up a man running down the grass from the depository. Robinson's story is supported by Roy Cooper, his employee who was in the car behind him. Cooper says that he saw the man running down the incline wave at the Rambler and then jump in. Neither Robinson nor Cooper were able to identify the person they saw running to the Rambler. Then we have Helen Forrest and James Pennington. They did get a good look at the man. Both Forrest and Pennington also say they saw a man running from the rear of the depository building down the incline into Dealey Plaza, and then get into a Rambler station wagon. Both Forrest and Pennington say the man they saw looked exactly like Lee Harvey Oswald. To summarize, we have Carr saying he saw the man in the tan sport coat from the sixth floor get in the Rambler a block away from Dealey Plaza on Record Street. And now we have a total of four witnesses who saw a man run from the back of the depository and get into a Rambler in Dealey Plaza. Robinson, Cooper, Forrest, and Pennington. Sheriff Roger Craig is the fifth witness to corroborate that story. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC. It's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click Shop by Mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary. Sheriff Craig was standing in front of the same courthouse that Carr was in when the motorcade passed. He heard gunshots, and then he started running into Dealey Plaza, where he began looking for bullet marks. Here's Roger Craig talking about what he saw.
As I was searching the south curb of Elm Street, I heard a shrill whistle. And I looked up. It just drew my attention. It was coming from across the street. And there was a light green Rambler station wagon driving real slow west on Elm Street. And the driver was leaning over to his right, looking up at a man running down the grass. So I immediately tried to cross the street to take these two people into custody for questioning. Just, you know, everybody else was coming to the scene. These were the only two people leaving. And this was suspicious in my mind, you know, at the time. So I wanted to talk to them. But I couldn't get across the street because the city officer who was stationed at Houston and Elm had left his post, and the traffic, you know, was so heavy, I just couldn't get across the street to him. But I did get a good look at the man coming down the grassy knoll. And he got into the station wagon, and they drove west on the Elm Street.
After securing and searching the depository building, Craig contacted the Dallas police to let them know what he had seen regarding the suspicious man getting into the Rambler.
I called Captain Fritz at his office and gave him a description of the man I saw get into the Rambler. And he told me, and I quote him, "It sounds like the suspect we have in custody. Come on up and take a look at him." So I went out and got in my unmarked car and drove to the city hall, went directly to Captain Fritz's office. And we went into Captain Fritz's inner office. And the man was sitting in a chair behind a desk. And there was another gentleman. I assumed he was one of Fritz's people because he had the white cowboy hat on, which was the trademark at that time of the Dallas Homicide Bureau. And Fritz turned to me and said, "Is this the man you saw?" And I said, "Yes." And it was.
Sheriff Roger Craig's positive identification of Oswald running down the hill, getting into the Rambler, makes Craig the third witness to see the same thing. He backs up what Helen Forrest and James Pennington saw. But what Craig says he heard Oswald say to Captain Fritz is a real head-scratcher.
So he turned to the suspect and he said, "This man saw you leave." At which time the suspect became a little excited. And he said, "I told you people I did." And Fritz said, "Now take it easy, son," talking to the suspect. He said, "We're just trying to find out what happened here." He said, "What about the car?" I didn't say station wagon. He said, "What about the car?" At which time the suspect leaned forward and put both hands up on the desk and said, "That station wagon belongs to Mrs. Payne. Don't try to drag her into this." Then he leaned back and very disgustedly said, "Everybody will know who I am now." Now, this was not a brag. I know it's been blown up to be a brag in the Warren Commission, but this was not a brag. This was a man
he was embarrassed about it.
Or disgusted that he had blown his cover or been caught or something. You know, it wasn't a brag.
Let's break down what Craig says Oswald told him and Captain Fritz. First, Oswald does not admit to leaving in the Rambler. He just admits to leaving the scene. In fact, Oswald himself is on the record saying that he took the bus and then a cab to get to his rooming house, which matches the Warren Report story. When Captain Fritz said, "This man saw you leave," Oswald responded, "I told you people I did." When Fritz asked Oswald, "Well, what about the car?" Oswald's response of, "That station wagon belongs to Mrs. Payne," don't try to bring her into this is very disorienting for a few reasons. First, neither Captain Fritz nor Sheriff Craig told Oswald that the car at issue was a station wagon. Oswald is the one who says station wagon for the first time. Oswald had no way to know the make or model of the vehicle that he was accused of fleeing in. So it's important to note that Oswald didn't say that Rambler belongs to Mrs. Payne. He said that station wagon belongs to Mrs. Payne. Second, Oswald's answer about the station wagon raises questions of whether Ruth Payne did, in fact, own a Rambler station wagon that would match the description of the light-colored approximately 1961 or 62 Rambler. The FBI looked into this issue, and they determined that Payne owned a light blue 1955 Chevy Bel Air station wagon. Some people want to believe that Payne's station wagon was used to pick up the Oswald lookalike, based on what Oswald told Craig. But there is just not enough evidence to support that idea. Yes, it's weird that Oswald immediately mentioned a station wagon when he was accused of fleeing the crime scene by car. How would Oswald have knowledge of that unless there was some elaborate conspiracy charade going on? I don't know. What I do know is that Ruth Payne did not own a vehicle that matched the description of the fleeing Rambler seen in Dealey Plaza that day. It's not surprising that Warren Report defenders have serious issues with Sheriff Craig's testimony. Vincent Bugliosi says he believes Craig was telling the truth about seeing the man run down the hill and get into the Rambler. That's because it was corroborated by other witnesses. But as far as Craig's testimony that the man he saw looked like Oswald, Bugliosi says Craig is either lying or made a sincere mistake because we know where the real Oswald was at that time, and Bugliosi is right about this. When it comes to the encounter with Oswald and Fritz at the police department, Bugliosi and the Warren Report itself argue that Sheriff Craig fabricated or at least exaggerated the entire story. Captain Fritz said, "I do remember a man coming to my outer office, and I remember one of my officers calling me outside the door of my private office. I talked to this man for a minute or two, and he started telling me a story about seeing Oswald leave the building. I don't remember all the things that this man said, but I turned him over to Lieutenant Baker, who talked to him." Bugliosi says that Lieutenant T.L. Baker, one of Captain Fritz's assistants, confirmed Fritz's story when Bugliosi personally asked him about it. Ultimately, Fritz and Baker corroborate all of Sheriff Craig's story about the Oswald encounter at the police department, except for the part about what Oswald said, which they deny. Like so many issues in the Kennedy assassination, the answer comes down to the question of who do you find more credible, Sheriff Craig or Captain Fritz and Lieutenant Baker? Now, it's easy to write Craig off as a kook, but remember, most of what he said is corroborated by other witnesses. And Craig wasn't just some random sheriff. He was well-respected by his peers, having won the Dallas County Sheriff's Man of the Year Award in 1960 after capturing an international jewel thief. He had been promoted 4 times at the Sheriff's Department before the assassination. Craig had 4 separate attempts on his life after the Kennedy assassination. It appears that Roger Craig either made a powerful and relentless enemy, or he was just very coincidentally unlucky. This is how Craig explains the repeated attempts to kill him. Quote, "I was shot at in 1967. In 1970, my car was blown up. In 1971, I was run off a mountain road in West Texas, so I have suffered somewhat. And to top it off, my wife left me in 1973. And when I do think I'm getting it together, someone blows my shoulder off with a shotgun." On May 15, 1975, Roger Craig was found dead from a gunshot wound to the chest from a rifle. His death was ruled a suicide. Craig's son and many people who knew him well believed that he was murdered. And there are a few weird facts surrounding Craig's death that raise suspicions of foul play. The wound that killed Craig was on a downward angle. It would be very difficult for a person to hold a rifle and shoot themselves in the chest from a downward angle. Another thing is that the rifle that killed him was laying on the bed while Craig's body was found in the middle of the bedroom floor. You would expect the rifle to fall to the ground if Craig had shot himself. There's also the .45 caliber handgun that was on Craig's dresser. Why would he use a rifle when he could use a handgun? And Craig didn't have suicidal tendencies, according to those who knew him best. He had just renewed his driver's license 3 days prior to his death and was said to be making jokes and in good spirits on the day he died. Finally, there's the burglary. When Roger Craig Jr. went to the morgue, the police had gathered his dad's things from the house where he lived, including his records and notes from the assassination, and brought them to the morgue. There were 6 or 8 boxes, according to Craig Jr. He says that he brought those boxes back to his grandmother's house, and one night later, the house was burglarized and all of the boxes that were at the morgue with Craig's personal effects had been stolen. On top of that, when Craig Jr. went to the bank to take control of his dad's account, which had more than $60,000 in it, he was told that the checkbook he presented was for an account that never existed at the bank. The money and the records of Craig's bank account had simply disappeared. I bring up the attempts on Craig's life and ultimately his death only because a major part of the case hinges on Craig's credibility. If he wasn't telling the truth about what he saw, then that means no one was trying to kill him and his concerns were just paranoia. It's hard to square that with the 4 attempts on his life and the circumstances surrounding his death. So how did Oswald leave the crime scene? Was it on a bus and then a taxi, or was it by jumping into a Rambler being driven by a dark-complected man? There's evidence for both. For the bus and taxi, we have testimony from the bus driver, Oswald's former landlady who happened to be on the bus, and William Whaley, the cab driver. Most importantly, Oswald has the bus ticket in his pocket when he's arrested. There's also a unique punch mark that ties the ticket to the specific bus the Warren Report says Oswald was riding. All of this evidence makes it almost certain that Oswald took the bus and then a taxi. Also, William Whaley would not know where Oswald's rooming house was if he didn't take Oswald there. That's a disturbing conclusion to make because you have to account for all of the Rambler witnesses who say a man ran down the hill and then got in the car and sped away. And 3 of those witnesses, Helen Forrest, James Pennington, and Sheriff Craig, identified the man getting in the car as looking just like Lee Harvey Oswald. We also have Richard Randolph Carr saying that he saw the same man in the tan sports coat on the 6th floor get into the Rambler on Record Street, a block away from Dealey Plaza. Ralph Yates swore that he gave a hitchhiker identical to Oswald a ride to the depository on the Wednesday morning before the assassination, and that man had a 4-foot-long brown paper sack that he said contained curtain rods. After passing a polygraph showing that Yates believed he was telling the truth, Yates was forcibly committed to a mental institution after he refused to change his story for the FBI. Yates' story and the uneven authoritarian response to it from the FBI tends to show that there could have been an Oswald lookalike involved in the assassination. If you think that sounds crazy, I agree. I dismissed it for the longest time as being absurd. But how else do you account for the testimony of the 3 witnesses, including Sheriff Craig, who say that they saw someone who looked just like Oswald get in the Rambler, if it was not, in fact, Oswald himself? We know the man running down the hill was not Oswald. So was he a lookalike? Was the man running to the Rambler the same hitchhiker Yates dropped off at the depository with a long brown paper sack on Wednesday? There are two more open questions with the Rambler. First, who was the dark-complected person who was driving it? Second, who was the man in the sport coat that was seen by Carr, Walther, and Worrell? If those three witnesses are correct, they saw someone who is at least a person of interest, since he was seen on the same floor as the shooter by Carr and Walther. Carr saw that person get into the Rambler that three other people said the Oswald lookalike had just gotten into. Maybe there were just a lot of men in sport coats that day in Dealey Plaza. On top of all of this, Sheriff Craig says that he confronted Oswald at the police department with information about the Rambler, and Oswald said it belonged to the woman his wife and kids were staying with, Mrs. Payne. What? Something does not add up here. The Warren Report ultimately rejected Roger Craig's testimony about seeing Oswald in the getaway Rambler and about Oswald telling him that it was Mrs. Payne's car. The commission said it believed Captain Fritz and Lieutenant T.L. Baker, not Sheriff Craig. Oswald was seen leaving on a bus and in a taxi, but a man who looked identical to him and a man in a brown sport coat were also seen leaving in a Nash Rambler driven by a dark-complected man. Obviously, Oswald cannot be in two places at the same time, and the Warren Report was correct about Oswald's movements between the time of the shooting and around 1 p.m. While the Warren Report got the real Oswald's post-assassination bus and taxi travel correct, it diminished and swept under the rug the Rambler that was seen by at least six witnesses. Richard Randolph Carr's story about the man in a tan sport coat that he saw on the sixth floor, then getting into the Rambler on Record Street, is a huge fact that needs further inquiry. If we determine that the Warren Report was wrong, then the Rambler, its driver, and the man in the tan sport coat are key figures in the assassination. It's too bad that the Warren Commission was not more concerned with the Rambler. If they were, maybe we would have a better idea about the identity of the mystery men inside of it. Next time on Solving JFK, we'll look at Oswald's rifle. Is there proof that he ordered that rifle? We'll also look at the fingerprints that were found on the rifle, the cartridges, and the ammunition. If you heard anything on this episode that lacks context or you think is incorrect, please let us know. You can email solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide a citation and we'll consider it for a future rebuttal episode.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information. I'm just